It's the Islamophobia edition of Radio Freethinker. This week, host emeritus Ethan Cloud joins us as we discuss, is Islam the worst religion in the world, in history? What the heck is wrong with Bill Maher and Sam Harris? The problem is Islamophobia in the liberal community. Let's begin episode 270.
It's time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of dark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know it all.
Across the sea of space, the stars are alert, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Today we are joined by host emeritus Ethan Clow. Say hello, Ethan.
So, yeah, stopping by, of course, my current show, The Sector Podcast, is going strong. By now, episode 24 will be up, so check that out online, sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And we've got some great content coming up in the next few weeks. We're looking to have with us a representative of Volunteer Canada, as well as an interview with the organization Women Moving Millions, which is all about the increasing financial philanthropic power of women across the world. So should be really fascinating couple of weeks. So tune in for that.
Well, congratulations on the number of shows. Keep going strong. Everything I know about it, it says it's a pretty good thing. We will eventually be discussing Islamophobia. And why are we doing that, you might ask? Well, recently there's been a major controversy in the liberal community. Can I say liberal community, Ethan?
Hold on, let me just double-check the dictionary of liberalism and community. Yes, you may.
Okay, so before we get to that, spoiler alert, we're not fans of Sam Harris or Bill Maher on this. That comment will make more sense during the second part of our discussion. However, before we can take a stand on the controversy, we must first answer the question at the heart of it. Is Islam the most violent religion? Well, let us first say that we're not talking historically. I think Christianity has nailed that down with the whole war, reformation, slavery, the Inquisition. That said, historically, all religions have had, how shall we say, dark moments. Sam Harris makes the claim it is the most violent ever, but I shall steelman his argument.
So, Don, steelmanning, I haven't heard that term before.
Well, it's kind of the opposite of strawmanning. That is, I intend to take the most generous and strongest possible interpretation of Harris's argument. So the real question at hand, then, is Islam the most violent religion currently? To test the theory that Islam is the most violent religion, we need to sort of universalize the question. That is, globally, is Islam the source of the most violence? And to address the elephant in the room, ISIS, is the Middle East unique? Well, is its root cause Islam or not? Yes and no. At the moment, it is the hotbed of war, as Africa was in the 60s, Latin America in the 70s. For those who are unaware, the Middle East, sans Israel, was seen as a relatively stable part of the world if you go back a couple of decades. During the 1960s, when France and Britain were extricating themselves from their colonies in Africa, well, at that time, that was the hotbed of violence in the world. The violence was often racial in context, like duh, and led to waves of terrorist groups like the Algerian Liberation Front, Zimbabwe African National Union, and the African National Congress of South Africa. Many people forget that it was not until 2008 that Nelson Mandela was delisted as a terrorist by the U.S. government. Then in the 70s and 80s, you had the same thing happen to the very Catholic South and Central America. Of course, most of these movements were actually crushed thanks to heavy support of violent dictators by the U.S., and it was not really until the 90s that most of these nations made a transition to, more or less peacefully, to a kind of democracy. Your thoughts on this first part, Ethan?
Well, you're quite right about the situation in the Middle East compared to, say, Africa. And a really good example of this, if anyone wants to do some more research, is to look at France's issue with Algeria in the 1960s, where basically France was trying to cling on to Algeria while Algeria was basically trying to get away, led to some really violent incursions. And, you know, the one of the things people maybe not realize is that the whole Vietnam kerfuffle was started by France. And it was part of France's attempt to hang on to its dwindling empire in the 60s. So, I mean, it's pretty easy to forget that the violence perpetrated back then was like a good deal more extreme than what we have right now.
And you know, that particular instance is doubled down when you look at the Dutch in the Indonesia area, where what was it, East Timor and all that, right? Where again, you had horrible oppressions, none of it really Muslim related, perpetrated by Western democracies, quote unquote, violently oppressing to the point of being state-sponsored terrorists of these groups.
Yeah, it was a really chaotic time, and the ironic thing about it too, you know, coming off of World War II, and the sort of makeshift alliance that the U.S. and Western Europe were building against the Soviet Union, you know, part of the reason to de-empire was that the U.S. was putting pressure on the European powers to, you know, be more democratic. Ironically, you know, in this case of France, after France said, okay, screw this, you know, F Vietnam, well, America was like, well, no, we can fix this. And so it's a little bit ironic that some lessons from history are still being repeated.
Yes. So with that historical context, we return to our question. If Islam was a violent religion, it should be more violent globally. And it's true that in the Middle East, it is sort of correlated. But outside of the Middle East, there doesn't really seem to be any correlation with Islam and violence. Let us not forget that Muslims are the subject of terrorism in Burma, that in Sri Lanka, the violence was between Buddhists and Hindus. The UK had Catholics versus Protestant terrorism, i.e. the IRA. The US's second worst terror attack was by a sovereign citizen type. Let's not forget Oklahoma. In fact, the vast majority of terrorist acts in the US are done by white anti-government or racist groups. There are some examples of violence that we don't really seem to count that are done by Muslims. Let us not forget the, quote, freedom fighters that we had in Afghanistan during the 80s. And currently we seem to see the Uyghur fighters in China as more, again, freedom fighters against Chinese authoritarian communism. And then, of course, you get ones that are getting from both sides, like in the Kashmir, which is sort of fighting for independence from both Pakistan and India. Any thoughts on these particular current, you know, if they're fighting for us, they're freedom fighters. If they're fighting against us, they're terrorists.
Well, I mean, the point that you mentioned there, Don, about in America with the sort of the white radical violence causers, the weird dichotomy, of course, is that, you know, if a Muslim blows up a building, it's terrorism. If a white person does it, they're crazy. And I think it just adds to this kind of blindness that we have in society. And I think, unfortunately, you know, Sam Harris, Bill Maher and his like, they either don't recognize this or they don't care. And they're just sort of happy to portray this as, you know, when someone in America blows something up, well, they're just insane. They're just lunatics. But as soon as it becomes a Muslim or any other nationality, it's terrorism. It's religiously motivated violence. And I think that that's pretty short-sighted.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of it, too, is on the reporting of such things, which I think we'll go into the second part of this, is Islamophobia a real thing or not? Because, again, you had the Norway massacre. Again, lone wolf, because he's a white Christian type guy. In the United States, there was this really crazy thing that happened in Georgia where you had, quote, right, white supremacists drive into one of the government buildings, guns a-blazing, right, in order to free America. And, again, his whole past, the fact that there's a whole large ideology of internal insurrection, revolution over the government, violence towards the people, just seems to get whitewashed because they're whitewashed.
Yeah, quite literally. I mean, and I was actually just reading a really unbelievable story from American history of how I believe it was near Cincinnati, there was a massive racist riot that led to like an entire neighborhood being burned down. And this was back in the 20s or 30s. But basically, it was just written right out of the history books until very recently. And it was like a massive terrorist attack, by white people on this black community. It was unbelievable. And it, you know, it kind of goes to show you that that history blindness that we're seeing in Sam Harris and Bill Maher, not recognizing what is real terrorism, totally absent of religion.
Okay, but let's keep our focus. Islam and violent uprising. Well, there are two areas we see outside of the Middle East where this is sort of happening, the Caucasus and Nigeria. I cannot help but note, or chuckle, the Caucasus is the root of Caucasian, i.e. white folks like you and me, Ethan, but I digress. Actually, it does bring up an important side note that we can address now as any time. Technically, Islamophobia is not racist, but racist-like. What do I mean by that? Well, technically, anyone who is a Muslim is subject to Islamophobia. But that not only includes the race, however defined, of Arab, but also black Africans, the Caucasus of southern former Soviet Union, the Gingers of Glasgow. Our language, I guess thankfully, doesn't actually have a term for social discrimination based on religious affiliations. You tend just to condemn the religious affiliation and not sort of the people behind it. Previously, we used to have something like Jews, where you could have had both religion and race subsumed into one. But that simply breaks down when you think about global Islam. So let's introduce our audience to a term, religionism, or and the religionist. Thinking of the term as sort of anti-Semitic, but more accurately anti-Muslim, or let's go old-school anti-Mohammedan. But here we have an issue, and I'm sure we'll discuss it later, that often the anti-Mohammedan is saying anti-Islam, but is thinking, and let's be generous, feeling anti-Arab, or more cruder, anti-brown skin. So Islamophobia, like anti-Semitism, is kind of a cross between a hatred or a disdain for a race and a religion. I suspect that Nazis would not have cared if Sammy Davis Jr. was not of Semitic blood, but only that his beliefs were proven to be defective by their particular means. Any thoughts on this, Ethan?
Well, you know, Don, if you were phobia towards Christians, Jews, and Muslims, you'd be anti-Abrahamic?
Yes, that would be true.
And okay. And if you were, phobic against monotheistic religions, what would you be, anti-Zoroastrian Abrahamic?
And what if you were, you know, prejudiced against all religion, would you be, no, I won't go to the A word. Okay, so let's get back on track. There are three non-Middle Eastern areas of Islamic conflict. First, Europe. And if you're not a right-winger, I just surprised you. Often the condemnation of Islam, the protestation of Muslims in Europe, is brought up. Most cited the Danish cartoons and the inspiration for Blasphemy Day. First, I should point out that many immigrants are still immigrants after two or three generations. Unlike here in Canada, most European nations are very strict and reluctant to give full citizenship to, quote, foreign types. And thanks to the European equivalent of Mexican immigrants, most of these foreign people are Muslims. They also tend to be an underclass, the exploited working class. So the violence that erupts over the infamous cartoons had more to do with the sense of social inequality than religionism. Most did not really care that much about the cartoon per se, but saw it as another insult to their existence, more of a caste thing than anything else. That said, as an aside, there were religious radicals who were willing to take advantage of the underlying social grievances and use them to promote both their own profiles as well as their cause célèbre, like global jihad. Any thoughts about European Islamic threat?
Well, yeah, Don, I think you hit the nail on the head there with focusing on sort of the economic and class factors. And of course, you know, France is always the go-to example of this, where you have a really large population of young Muslim folk who are, you know, in a very low economic status. They don't really have a lot of representation in politics and society. And they're basically kind of ostracized as not being, you know, truly French. And of course, you know, France is one of those countries where that's a big issue if you don't blend into the rest of the society. And you're also seeing it represented in England, in the UK. And it's starting to show its face all over in Germany and the Scandinavian countries as well. Switzerland, the whole minarets thing. It's focusing in on a vulnerable population. And when you do that, you force them to become more insular, and you know they start to look for anything that can that they can rally behind, and you know religion is going to be one of those things.
And this becomes a very generational thing as well. I mean, this has happened before, where you grow up and you see there's something wrong with your society and you feel the urge to change it. And the urge to change it tends to be on whatever the cleavage is of the moment. I mean, in the 60s, you had racism as the big thing. In the 70s, there was the women's movement. And the fact that this seems to be a bit more violent is because the violence being inflicted, or the sort of the focus point, i.e. the Middle East, is much more violent. There wasn't that kind of violence going on in the 60s. There was a lot of violence locally, as we talked about with as far as local terrorism, but not in the same sort of global thing. And I think that's why you get a lot of these, what is the big fear now with radicalized people at home going to these countries to fight these religious wars?
Yeah, the sort of idea of like terrorism, tourism or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and if you're sitting there and you're at home and you're in Calgary, let's say, let's be generous, because I think France would be even worse, and, you know, you've got no roots, you've lost your job, maybe your girlfriend's gone, you're feeling a bit lost, and then someone says, hey, let me show you something nice. And there are all types that will do this. The neo-Nazis will do this, Islamists will do this, Christian proselytes do this. We never get really upset when we send missionaries over to Africa to teach people that gays should be killed or that this woman is a witch and we need to exorcise her, but they really get upset when they go over there to be, quote, freedom fighters from a perspective. In fact, I was just listening the other day that Holland is changing its laws to allow a biker gang to go to Kurdistan to fight ISIS, which goes against their traditional laws because, again, those are the good guys, and we want to help the good guys kill the bad guys, however you define that.
Well, yeah, I saw that story, too. It's pretty ridiculous. I mean, the thing that's important to remember with regards to that kind of indoctrination, it happens independent of religion. As you mentioned, like neo-Nazi groups, racist groups use that kind of method for bringing in new recruits. Cults use that for brainwashing people. There's nothing inherently religious about that.
Okay, returning to our question. Globally, Muslims are behaving badly in two areas, Nigeria and the Caucasus. Let's look at Nigeria. Boko Haram is a violent Muslim militia that has done bad things. We think currently about 200 or so girls that were abducted and used either as sex slaves or hostages. Regardless, they are violent terrorists, or more generously, insurgent group in Nigeria with the aims of making a religiously pure state. Not good, not defending them. But so is the Christian Kong. Quote, a militant movement that has described variously as being quasi-Christian, Christianist, or extremist Christian. And there are far more Christian groups like that in Africa. Remember, blood diamonds and child soldiers is not a Muslim thing, but an African thing. Actually more prevalent by Christian-type groups. So it seems not to be, again, an Islamic thing, but an African thing. The same could be said for female genital mutilation. Yes, FGM is very prevalent, almost universal in Muslim nations. But countries like Eritrea and maybe Ethiopia, those are actually majority Christian nations. 9 out of 10 of the countries that practice this in Africa are Muslim majority. That said, I would still say this is an African thing because outside of Africa, it's almost unheard of. Well, at least from the data that I could find, that if this was an inherent part of Islam, you would expect it being occurred in Afghanistan, in Indonesia, wherever Islam is, but it's only in this one particular local strip of Africa that it's happening, so I think you can give them a bit of a pass as far as Muslims being the source of it, as opposed to some historical African tradition that is the source of it. Do you have any thoughts on that, Ethan?
Well, I think it just goes to show sort of how culture and society will bleed into each other, and you will get kind of a merging of different views. You know, North Africa, one of the most diverse places in the world, you're going to get all kinds of different thoughts and philosophies merging together like this.
Yeah. Okay, so what about the Caucasus? Well, they're close enough to the Middle East and have a similar influence, imperial subjugation and Wahhabism. That's something I'm going to talk about later, but that I'm actually going to call them the same. I'm going to group them into the Middle East, although technically they're not part of it. Now, I know I'm moving rather quickly over the Caucasus. Do you think I'm being unfair in that, Ethan?
If I said yes, what would you do?
I'd ask why.
Well, then I'll say no.
Okay. Of course, you might ask about the Bali bombing, 9/11, 7/11, Boston Marathon. Well, yes, these were Muslim actors, but they were by and large lone wolves. In fact, in the U.S., there are exponentially more terrorist attacks perpetrated by sovereign citizens or white supremacists than any religious-related groups. Before we move on, thoughts about the lone wolf theory. Does it seem strange that any attack by an Arab, Muslim, or brown-skinned person is part of a global conspiracy? But if they're white, well, that's just a lone wolf, a crazy man like we saw in Norway. We've kind of already touched on this, Ethan. So you agree with this, obviously.
Yeah, I think we sort of talked about this at length. And I mean, the interesting thing about this, too, is the way that we really sort of minimize the sort of homegrown terrorist into the crazy person or the relics of history. I mean, the large-scale terrorism that was enacted by white supremacists, you know, all the way up to the 1960s, really, we have a tendency to kind of gloss over that and focus in on the one or two instances of, you know, a foreign national committing a terrorism act.
And I'd like to jump on the racist part. I would. I'd like to. I'd love to. But you did have the same sort of global conspiracy thing with the communists and all that. But I'm going to get into that later. Okay. But one must acknowledge that what is happening in the Middle East is at least, by modern standards, fairly extreme. Although common in Saudi Arabia, beheading is vis-a-vis terrorism sort of an Islamic development. Let's not forget Daniel Perlman's beheading in Pakistan in 2002. Beyond that, there is sort of this ongoing ethnic thinning, or if not ethnic cleansing, in the region. However, this too is not really unique to the area. Such things have happened in Africa, let's remember Rwanda. Let's not forget the breakup of Yugoslavia. But Islam is not the only innovators of terror. One thing brought up as condemnation, and justly, the action of these groups to use rape as a terror weapon, or sex slavery. The modern incarnation of this practice first emerged not in a Muslim country, but Rwanda, an overwhelmingly Christian nation. And I don't mean soldiers running amok, that's been going on for as long as humans have been around, but sort of a systematic use of rape to destroy the community. I'm sure there are other social disgraces that have been used to demoralize the, quote, other side. Do you think this is uniquely Islamic?
Well, you know, I don't think so. And some of the research that comes out of organizations like the UN or the World Health Organization, they suggest that, you know, sex slavery and trafficking of human beings is not uniquely Islamic. In fact, it appears to be going on all over the world, in Russia, in Asia, India, Africa, South America. And indeed, we're not immune to this in North America either. It happens here as well. So, again, I think that we need to take off the sunglasses when we look at, you know, the West, and start to see some of the problems are existing here as well.
But I do think, though, that there is something going on here, and that, in fact, that this region has been a active war zone for years, decades if you count the Saddam years. We worry about soldiers who spend a few months over there who are so traumatized that they're no longer able to function. If PTSD affects them in a few months, what dire effects does it have on someone who's grown up in this environment? This is one point that I think supports the "this is uniquely bad, but is it Islamic?" Well, there is one thread I did find that does sort of tie this all together as an Islamic plot of sorts, and this brings us back to those beheadings. Saudi Arabia has part of its legal system beheading. This is unique in the world. A couple of states sort of have beheadings on the books, but something they no longer practice. It's estimated that about 60 people have had their heads removed this year alone. Now, a bit of a confession here. Most of the sources I could find refer to these as executions. Whether they are all or just some are done as beheadings, I can't actually say for sure, but I can say that definitely some have been beheadings. Another thing that ties almost all the extreme violent Islamic groups, and I dare say Muslim individuals, is that they have all been heavily influenced by the Wahhabi sect of Islam, the one that is supported and funded by the Saudi government and moneyed elite. Side note, the relationship between Wahhabi and the Saudi royal family is important. When Saad bin al-Saad unified the peninsula, he needed some form of traditional support in order to do this. The Wahhabis agreed to sort of provide the religious authenticity to the king in exchange for state support. This leads to a fuzzy but real correlation of Saad support as a cover term for Wahhabi proselytization. Now, there is a historical parallel. First, Saudi missionaries and money have been looking for opportunities to spread in the world. Often places in conflict are actually the best place to sort of find new recruits. The parallel I would make here is the Soviet Union. They would often offer support to struggling groups around the world. And because of this social political situation on the ground, i.e. living under a U.S.-supported dictatorship, these often resulted in violence and occasional revolution. There, of course, was a parallel, one where the U.S. supported death squads in places like El Salvador and Nicaragua. Was that a plot or political opportunism? But let's stick with the politically correct Soviet drive to take over the world. It works better for my argument. So on the one hand, you do have a kind of global conspiracy, but not of socialism or even communism. Those people who believed in that system were very peaceful in, quote, settled areas like Canada, the UK, excluding, of course, some lone wolves. Now, the violence only arose in places where oppression and social turmoil already existed. Did the outside players, Saudi or Soviets, play a role in sparking a fire in fertile ground? Yes, but it was only a sect of the larger, communist and Muslim, not the movement as a whole. Unlike the Soviet Union, the Wahhabis are not preaching social justice, equality, at least beyond what serves their propagandic purpose. They're preaching sort of slavery to religion. Sorry, I still think religion is innately wrong. What else did you exactly expect them to say? But I think the threat is still there, that you have these opportunistic players who are sort of plotting, but they're plotting for their own narrow purposes, and they're not representative of the larger whole. That said, do you have any comments, Ethan?
I think that pretty uniquely sums up what the situation is in terms of the... You have radicals and you have people who see an opportunity to enhance their own power base. And they're going to use whatever instances they have at their disposal to get that power base. You know, the Soviet Union is a good example of that. So, again, I think this is another area where people like Sam Harris and Bill Maher totally overlook and miss the sort of wider context and the nuance of the situations that go into why we have this kind of violence erupting in different parts of the world.
So let's return to our original question. On the evidence we have presented, could one make the argument that Islam is worse than any other religion? Well, maybe parts are sects, but only by degree and not of kind. Let us not forget the aggressive work of evangelical Pentecostal Christians have done to make homosexuality a capital offense in Africa. They're working on bringing back witchcraft as a thing, like we're not past the 14th century. To make it extreme, saying all Islam is the worst because of Wahhabism is very bad would be like saying all Christianity is the worst because of the Westboro Baptist Church. That's the God hates fags people. And I think that's just crazy.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, on that note, I think that kind of ties us into the second part of this conversation, which we will do after this break.
Canadians are being bought and sold. We can no longer ignore this reality. Each of the 27 million human trafficking victims around the globe has a unique story. 80% of victims are women, 50% are children. This is not only a global injustice, but a local reality. It is happening right now in my community. We are asking you to take action today. Visit endexploitation.com. Get informed and take action. British anti-slavery leader William Wilberforce once said, "Having heard all this, you may choose to look the other way, but you can never say again that you did not know. The only question now is, what will you do?" Join us and help eliminate human slavery in Canada.
SpongeBob, you're wasting me precious carbon dioxide. I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open my latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool.
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable. Big business does it again.
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy. If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreethinker.com.
And we're back. Okay, now the focus, or maybe inspiration for this segment, was the recent dust-up between Bill Maher and Sam Harris against Ben Affleck. And in particular, Maher's and Harris's calling out of liberals for being weak and hypocritical when it comes to criticism of social ills and labeling all criticism of Islam about said social ills as Islamophobia. First, there's a bit of a straw man. No one is saying that any criticism of Islam is hateful. That especially specific criticisms of specific groups and their specific actions would be counted as a hate speech. A good analogy comes to mind. Those people who scream that any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism, and those people who actually say anti-Semitic things under the guise of criticism of Israel, or the entertainment industry, or you kind of get the idea. But that said, I'm going to now turn over the show to Ethan for this part of the discussion, because this is more something closer to his heart.
Well, thanks, Don. I appreciate that. I don't know if listeners maybe they don't know the sort of context of what we're talking about. But if you go online, you can probably find the videos of Sam Harris and Bill Maher arguing with Ben Affleck. And I mean, like, first of all, I think we should maybe say, not that we suggest that the actor who is going to be playing Batman is a foremost expert on Islam, but I think that it actually does demonstrate a bit of the hypocrisy of the situation, whereas Sam Harris and Bill Maher, who, you know, both like to think of themselves as liberals and spokespeople for the liberal community, they don't even really have buy-in from some of the, you know, stereotypically most liberal supporters, which are, you know, wealthy white actors. So I think that's kind of interesting.
I would agree. In fact, I mean, it's embarrassing sometimes, especially with Bill Maher, that you always have to kind of apologize when everyone says, oh, well, he's an atheist or he's a skeptic, because he's not really. He has some of the ideas that I agree with, but I would far, far say that he's not representative of our community. And when he pretends to be, it becomes very awkward.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, so let's focus in on Sam Harris for the moment. And one of the things that I wanted to talk a bit about is Sam Harris's reputation for making controversial claims, albeit sometimes very eloquently. He is a good speaker and all that. But this is a pattern that he has. He'll go out there and he'll make a statement. He'll then get criticized by experts in the field. And I'm not saying that Ben Affleck is an expert. I'm talking about, you know, actual academic experts. And then Harris will, you know, typically respond with a statement that more or less says, well, I'm still right, and it's wrong to me and mean to for people to criticize me. And this will usually provoke a deeper analysis of why Harris is wrong, and sometimes will lead to an engagement or a debate with people. But it usually ends with him kind of doubling down and refusing to budge. And we've seen this pattern when Harris first came out as an atheist, and he was criticized by the anthropologist Scott Atran for lumping all Muslims together, and, you know, this is sort of what we talked about. And again, it came up when Harris was promoting racial profiling in airport security, and he was criticized by security expert Bruce Schneider. and who, you know, is an accomplished writer. He's written for the New York Times, The Economist, The Guardian, Forbes, et cetera, et cetera. So he's, you know, one of the foremost experts in the field. He even did a debate with Sam Harris. And again, Harris kind of doubled down and said, no, no, I'm still right about this. And, you know, we can go on. There's, this pattern continues for when Harris advocated for torture, when he claimed that he knew more about philosophy despite not studying it, and also for advocating the use of keeping firearms in your house.
You know, sorry, just to jump in there, you know, I think you're absolutely right with Sam Harris. He's trained as a neurobiologist. He does have some background. But sometimes people get the idea that, hey, I've got a bit of celebrity. That makes me an expert on everything. And because I am a celebrity, everything I say has to be true, irrespective of whether it's true or not. And I think, again, you see this, I think, better with Bill Maher than you see with Sam Harris. I think Sam Harris just has a stronger veneer of academia than Maher does. But the more Harris keeps opening his mouth, the more that veneer gets rubbed off. I mean, he was part of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, wasn't he?
Well, and that's, I think, one of the interesting aspects about the whole thing is that when Harris and Hitchens and Dawkins and Dennett, and I think also it's also kind of a little bit strange to keep referring to them as sort of like these avatars of atheism when people like James Randi and Madeleine O'Hare and Jennifer Michael Hecht and others were, you know, writing this content long before they came along. But anyway, you know, after 9/11, people were really eager to, particularly with Islam, but I think in other religions as well, get on sort of the atheist bandwagon, and they really sort of capitalized on it. And I think now, in the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, we've really sort of dialed that back in the atheist community, and there's been a lot more, I think, scholarly critical analysis of, you know, the sort of new atheist movement. And I think a lot of people are kind of saying, you know, actually, I don't know if they're all that right. I mean, maybe there's nuggets of truth there, and there are certain aspects of that that we respect and that we want to apply further. But I think a lot of people are kind of going back and saying, you know, I don't think that Harris, as a neurologist, is qualified to be talking about, you know, the grand history of religion, Islam, and society in the Middle East.
No, I think I would agree. And I think one of the things we're running up against here, and you get this, I think, in all movements, is the idea of hero worship versus idea acceptance. So Sam Harris, he's had a few good ideas, and I like the ideas with regards to, and specifically, that moderate religion creates a mind space where crazy people can exist. You know, if I sat there and I said, hey, I'm talking to my dog, and my dog is telling me to give money away, we would still say that is just as crazy if the dog said to shoot people. But if I sat there and said, listen, God talked to me, he said I should help the homeless, we go, oh yeah, that's okay. Which means when the guy who says God talked to me and says I should shoot people, he has this extra intellectual space where it seems somewhat acceptable. And it was great. But Sam Harris has said a lot of horrible things. So I don't support the people. I support their ideas. And I think that's one of the things that we're seeing in the atheist, skeptic, liberal community, however you want to define that, is people have a tendency to hero worship. Because some of the people who've been trying to defend Maher and Harris have done so, to be fair, almost dogmatically. It's like, no, Sam Harris said this. They're all against us. We need to pull together. And I think that's a problem.
Yeah. And if you look at the way Harris tends to respond to criticism, it's always he tends to overplay this notion that his opponent is almost like rudely misinterpreting him as though they should know better. And it's like what you were saying earlier, what was the phrase you used, steel manning. And I don't know about you, Don, but I've been reading Dan Dennett's latest book, and he talks about this, how when you're engaging with somebody, you're doing yourself a service if you can rephrase their argument in a way that makes sense. If you take a very generous view of what they're trying to say, and you almost, you want to phrase it so that they actually say to you, wow, that's a great idea. Why didn't I think of that? And when you do that with Harris, you can get a little bit of play out of it. I mean, I actually agreed with his thesis in The Moral Landscape. But again, like the way that he presents his evidence and the way that he presents his views for, you know, other issues, there's really not a lot of basis there to stand on. And I think that even some of these experts like Scott Atran and Bruce Schneider, they would probably agree that there's some element of truth to what Harris is saying. But he's using really flimsy evidence to prop it up.
I think, too, what you see in Harris is something you see a lot of people who are of that ilk is the whole playing the victim card. You know, I'm just saying the truth that everyone's ganging up on me. Why is it all about me now? And, of course, missing the fact that, well, it's kind of all about you because you said it and you said it about something that doesn't really hold true.
Yeah, and I think to move on to the subject of Islamophobia, which is one of Harris's big things, like, let's just state, like, this is a real thing. I mean, if I go into a restaurant and my waiter is Muslim and I say, you know, excuse me, I want a different waiter, please, a non-Muslim, you know, that's textbook Islamophobia. So it seems like Harris and Marr and others like them think that Islam is this big, monolithic, widespread, uniform thing. And that there's no way to separate the big problems from the nuisances. And I say nuisances because, like every religion, Islam does have these little backwards things that are irritating, and they probably bug, you know, atheists a lot. But if you take these issues aside, they're not going to kill anybody. They're not, you know, the most pressing concerns in the world. And if you take all these issues and you expand them to include all Muslims, then, you know, it's just wrong. You're not helping anything. You're not fooling anybody. You're just creating a stereotype and applying it to a massive group of people. You know, a good way to think about this is if you want to put up like a cross or the Ten Commandments somewhere, it might be annoying, and there might be some symbolic issues you have with that. But again, it's not gonna kill anybody. It's not gonna change the world. Compare that to if you're, you know, making it illegal for a woman to get an abortion on religious grounds. That could kill somebody. That is a big problem. And again, so these things exist. They're parallel in religions, and they're all there. But if you lump those all together and just assume that because of one, ergo the other exists, you're creating a very schizophrenic view of the world. And I think it's rather silly of Harris to do that.
Yeah, no, I think you got it right there, Ethan. When you're sitting there and saying, you know, if a part of a faith or something has this very horrible aspect, that you must somehow universalize it to the whole group. You know, we were talking, I think, just a little while ago about this Jewish cult, for lack of a better word, that actually left the country because they weren't allowed to do the barbaric things they wanted to do here in Canada, so they thought to go to someplace else, where, of course, they were promptly rejected as well. But you couldn't, it doesn't seem fair to sort of universalize that to all of the group. It would be like saying, because some Americans are torturing prisoners in Gitmo, therefore all Americans are torturers.
Yeah, and I think it also neglects to understand the nuance that goes across all religious spectrums. I mean, I don't think you would ever really say that every Catholic person everywhere literally believes that wine in a cracker actually turns into blood and flesh. I mean, some people do, but most Catholics, I think, probably don't think that. Likewise, you know, most Catholics probably are okay using birth control. I mean, I know a few of them who do. So it's not like you can, even within the normal spectrum of religious belief, expect to find universal agreement.
And go and playing off of that with abortion, because that's sort of the hot topic in the States at the moment, or one of them, it would be unfair to make a generalization that, you know, most Americans are against abortion, that abortion is a sin, sinners should be killed, therefore most Americans think that anyone who gets an abortion should be killed. And yet that very same argument tends to get played out with apostasy or something like that in Middle East countries. Or another example, there's a big kerfuffle about wearing the hijab or niab or what have you, but no one ever complains about the dress codes that fundamentalist Christians force upon their own children and their wives and such things, which seems to be very, very much in parallel.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think that if we're going to be focused on the nitty-gritty detail, we have to be logically consistent across the board. And again, I think that, you know, this is another area where Sam Harris and folks like him, you know, really aren't. They seem to sort of only focus on the, you know, the scary Islam and not so much on the you know, rather silly aspects of things like Christianity or Buddhism or Taoism or something like that.
I think at the root there's actually a simple but glaring logical fallacy is, you know, the whole a cow has four legs, my dog has four legs, therefore my dog is a cow. You know, ISIS is a very bad terrorist group. ISIS is Muslim, therefore Muslims are very violent terrorists.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's something you learn in Philosophy 101, which, you know, obviously Sam Harris didn't attend by his own admission.
So what do you think about the whole idea then that that liberals are somehow being bad?
Well, I disagree with Harris and Marr. I think that there are plenty of liberals out there who are willing to criticize Muslims. The key difference, though, is that if you're going to focus on a specific action or event and not just broadly saying Islam is bad, you know, to go back to my waiter metaphor, if my waiter is carrying the food to the table, it trips and falls and drops everything, are we going to criticize all of Islam for this? I mean, of course not. That makes no sense. If the waiter was, you know, trying to pray and walk at the same time, we could criticize him as a Muslim and say, well, he's not a very good Muslim. He hasn't practiced coordination of praying and walking with food at the same time. But you still wouldn't generalize this to all of Islam. You would say, you know, maybe there are Muslims out there who have become very good at praying and carrying food at the same time. You know, and this is taking my metaphor to some weird extreme territory, but nevertheless, I mean, it does make sense. You wouldn't focus on an individual and then extrapolate that person to the entire group of people just because of some minor thing that they've done. Just again, it doesn't make sense. It's not logically consistent. And Harris and Marr should recognize that.
Right. And I think it's fair I'm trying to think what the right word is here. I'm quite willing to say it's okay to criticize African Muslims for female genital mutilation. It's a horrible thing. It mainly happens in African Muslim communities, so they get the brunt of it, if not exclusively, because as we said, there are other countries that do it as well. But I think I can criticize them as a specific and generalized group, but that doesn't mean you have to universalize it to all. But I think where we have another particular issue maybe is, what about the true universals? I mean, you're an atheist, I'm an atheist. I think religion in general, and not necessarily, well, I don't hear so, is it equal or not, fosters intolerance, fosters authoritarianism, fosters a sense of illogic. And that I would cast upon the waters. I would say all Islam does that. I might also say all Christianity does that. What about those kind of complaints? I mean, is there a point where it's okay to criticize an entire group, in this particular case, Islam?
Well, I mean, possibly. I mean, if you're going to make the case that, you know, religion is inherently bad, and, you know, I don't know if I would say that it's inherently bad. I think that religion, from my understanding of it, is that it kind of enables lazy thinking. It enables logical fallacies. Now, of course, the same can be true of so many other things. You know, any kind of strong political bias can potentially bias you, obviously, to other things. If you're a fervent supporter of PETA and PETA goes into something stupid, you know, you may not be able to reconcile that with you, and you'll be tempted to defend them and say that, you know, oh, well, they do so much good stuff that it's okay that they do a little bit of bad stuff, too. So any kind of political or social or strongly held belief has the potential to intellectually limit your abilities. Religion is no exception. Now, I mean, again, is religion inherently different? I don't know. My gut instinct is that yes, it is. But again, it's really hard to say. I think as atheists, and as, you know, we had so much experiences on Radio Free Thinker of learning about these sort of things and thinking about these sort of things, is that you're never going to be quite sure what the root cause of a problem actually is until you get a really thorough understanding of the situation. And again, you know, there's so many variables that go into whether or not you're going to be intellectually compromised by a belief system or a political view. So it's a tough call. I mean, it really, really is going to be difficult to say. And I think that should give us enough pause that, you know, we don't want to create these sort of blanket condemnations of huge groups of people.
I think another interesting aspect that comes into this is, how do we put this, how we timeshare our criticisms. If you sit there and say, no, I think all religions are bad, and then spend 99.9% of your time condemning Islam, that I think plays to something that's a deeper underlying aspect. I mean, you mentioned bias, and I would go a little bit further and say bigotry can play into this as well. When you play almost a lip service to the universality, but your actions play so much more to your very specific one disdain or hatred.
Yeah, and I think that this is something that Sam Harris and Bill Maher are both quite guilty of. I mean, they've on many occasions said how they believe that all religion is bad, all religion is dangerous, but of them, Islam is the worst. And again, I think that that's really, really a reach. I mean, we've talked about it at length on the show about why that is such a logical jump. And again, you know, the logical trappings that a religion can impose on the way you think, whether it's something like giving yourself an ability to justify atrocity, or whether it limits your ability to think critically and analytically about a problem or whatever it is, Islam is the same as the rest of them at doing that. So, I mean, it takes the kind of person who's going to say, if I kill all these people, you know, what justification can I think about to allow that to happen? Certain people will be convinced by simply saying, you know, oh, well, God told me to do it. And some people will say, no, it doesn't matter if God's telling me to do it. I'm not going to do it. It's unfortunate that in the Bible, most people tend to end up in hell. But, you know, that's just sort of how the ball rolls sometimes.
And I think this goes back to one of the constant themes that I like to try and promote, is that there sort of is a good way and a bad way to come to your beliefs. Like, Bill Maher, I think, is an atheist, and I'm glad he's an atheist, but I think he's an atheist for a very wrong reason. He's an atheist because he hates religious groups. Or he disdains authority. I think it's more the authority part. It's not because he sat back and said, listen, this is how the system works. This is my particular view on it. It goes against a certain logical framework that I've developed. Great. So then you can sort of be a good one, a good atheist in that sense, and you wouldn't fall into these same sort of pitfalls. The same way with his stance on GMOs. He doesn't hate GMOs because he's gone into the science and says, hey, listen, this is the particular risks and benefits of GMOs. He hates GMOs because he hates Monsanto because it's an evil corporation. And that's the wrong reason to be against something.
Yeah, and I think it ignores the historic context. I mean, if we're atheists, we believe that religion was invented by human beings, and it was. So, you know, you can look at, you know, the Bible, and you can clearly see that there is that dichotomy there between, you know, sins that only make sense for a, you know, 2,000-year-old religion, like the whole thing about, I can't remember the details, but Christianity has a real thing about goats and sheep. I mean, like, that's only relevant if you're subsisting on, you know, growing your own crops, because goats are going to damage your fields with their hooves, and they eat stuff and that kind of thing, whereas sheep aren't as bad or something. You know, like, that's only going to be valid in that context. And yet, you know, they've carried on that tradition. So, I mean, the evidence is right there in front of you. This is a human-made construct, and the fact that it has all these archaic references that no longer make sense today, you know, certain days when you can't eat meat and certain animals that you can't slaughter and, you know, that certain trees aren't supposed to come into bloom early or something. I can't remember why. Jesus really hated those trees.
He did. It wasn't big on pork either.
Yeah.
Although better, I guess, than Moses was.
Yeah.
But I thought there was one thing I thought was really funny that came out of all this, and I'm not going to get it all right, but one of the Islamic apologists, Reza Aslan, who's been in the news a fair amount of time. I love, in sort of trying to take down the Bill Maher and Sam Harris argument, essentially said, well, you know, we did just make up religion. There is no sort of commandments out there. It's whatever our social group makes them. In fact, to quote him, no religion exists in a vacuum. On the contrary, every faith is rooted in the soil which it is planted. It is a fallacy to believe that people of faith derive their primary values from their scriptures. The opposite is true. People of faith insert their values into their scriptures, read them through the lens of their own culture, ethnicity, nationality, and even political perspective. After all, scripture is meaningless without interpretation. Scripture requires a person to confront and interpret it in order to have any meaning. And the very act of interpreting the scripture necessarily involves bringing to it one's own perspective and prejudice. The same Bible that commands Jews to, quote, love thy neighbor as yourself, also exhorts them to, quote, kill every man, woman, and child, and infant, ox, and sheep, camel, and donkey, who worships another god. The same Jesus Christ who told his disciples to turn the other cheek also told them to, quote, not come to bring peace, but the sword, and that he who does not have a sword shall sell his cloak and buy one. And the Quran that warns believers, if you kill one person, it is as though you have killed all of humanity, also commands them to slay the idolater wherever you may find them. If you're a violent misogynist, you will find plenty in the scriptures to justify your beliefs. If you are a peaceful, democratic feminist, you will find justification in the scriptures for your point of view. So, am I wrong? Did he just say, we just make it up however we feel?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, okay. I thought that was quite funny.
Well, it is.
I think we might have run out of steam on this topic. Is there any last thing, word, comment, thing of the week, year you want to share with our audience before you go?
Well, I'll just once again remind people to download the latest episode of The Sector, again, at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com, and be sure to tune in next Friday when I engage on more sort of nonprofit social justice-y stuff.
It sounds really, really good. And again, Ethan, just a hint, I'd love to see something about Doctors Without Borders. It's a wonderful group with what they're doing in everywhere, but especially in the West African Ebola. But that's your show, not my show.
Well, we'll tune into episode 24.
Okay. So, time to say goodbye, Ethan.
All right. Well, thanks for having me, Don, and good work. And once again, thanks for all the listeners for tuning in.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Till the stars, a still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise, a morning filled with 400 million suns, or the rising of the Milky Way.
Remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder, treason, and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgotten. The only verdict is vengeance, a vendetta, held as a votive, not in vain, for the value and veracity of such shall one day vindicate the vigilant and the virtuous. as an idea, Mr. Creedy. And ideas are bulletproof.